The time is now 8:31 a.m. on January 19th, 2022, and I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, would you please call the roll?
Yes. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Ms. Shreve? We have quorum.
Thank you. Agenda number 3, case discussion and decision. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statutes 2081H, may dismiss complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for further review and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 3220-81H1. Upon a vote of a majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 3843-431.03A2. To review confidential records, or subsection A3, to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Ms. Galvin. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon parties present and requests to speak. A person or a representative of a person who has filed it or received a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. To the committee when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for those who speak. Please use initials only for patients, children, and the complainant. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. The first complaint to be discussed today is case number 2206 for Suzanne Adams. I am the lead on this case and will provide the committee with a summary. In just a second. Okay. In 2015, the complainant TW participated in individual therapy with Dr. Adams at her private practice for a total of 14 sessions. At the time, TW was married to her second husband. TW subsequently divorced her second husband and remarried a few months later. TW had two daughters from her previous marriages, a toddler and a teenager. Between 2017 to 2018, TW re-engaged in treatment with Dr. Adams for a total of 11 sessions to address marital issues and blended family dynamics. Her ex-husband participated in some of these sessions. Dr. Adams represents that ex-husband participated as a collateral. In November of 2017, during the course of treatment, TW sent Dr. Adams an email where she posed a hypothetical situation in which a child reported that an adult touched them inappropriately in a pool in 2015, but that the adult told them it was an accident. Dr. Adams responded that TW could submit a report which could be filed anonymously. On January 26, 2018, TW brought daughter to Dr. Adams' office. She did not attend sessions previously. Dr. Adams discovered that daughter was the child referenced in the hypothetical question that TW posed, and that the adult was her ex-husband. Daughter described the situation at the pool to Dr. Adams. Dr. Adams subsequently discussed daughter's disclosure with ex-husband the next day during an individual session, and with both TW and ex-husband during a therapy session approximately 3 weeks later. She also consulted with a colleague who was her former supervisor on January 27th regarding what daughter reported. Dr. Adams represents that she did not submit a report as she did not have reasonable belief that abuse occurred. In 2019, after therapy sessions had ended, TW separated from ex-husband and they ultimately divorced in early 2020. In January of 2020, at TW's request for purposes related to ex-husband's immigration proceedings, Dr. Adams wrote a brief letter indicating they had 11 couples therapy sessions between 2017 and 2018. In August of 2021, TW submitted a report to DCS against ex-husband regarding the incident the daughter reported after learning that a friend's daughter was also filing a report against him. TW represents that the Phoenix Police Department is currently investigating the matter. On September 1st, 2021, TW filed a complaint against Dr. Adams, alleging that she failed to report the sexual abuse that daughter relayed to her in 2018, as required by law for mandated reporters. TW also alleged that Dr. Adams advised her to stay in an abusive relationship with ex-husband. And that concludes my summary of the case.
We do have the complainant TW here, Dr. Meyer, so we can go ahead and hear from her.
Thank you. TW, would you please state your initials only for the record? This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Yes. Hi, this is TW. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for hearing me today. First, I want to ask, can I dispute some of the facts presented in your summary?
Yes, you are welcome to point out anything that you would like us to know.
Okay. So between my second and my third marriage, it was 1 year later, not a couple months later. there was more than just the pool abuse disclosed to Dr. A. There was much more than that. And I believe I detailed that in the complaint, or I know I did. So everything in that complaint was disclosed to Dr. A at the time. It was not just one pool incident. Also, I did not have knowledge of the other reporter, and I did not file my report with CPS because of that other reporter coming forward. It was purely coincidental. I'd actually forgotten about that incident. And my daughter told me after I let her know that I contacted CPS and filed the report that this other reporter messaged her on a social media platform that she had done the same. So, okay. I want to just read through something. Those are the only things that I wanted to dispute from your summary. Other than that, it seemed pretty close to correct. In 2015, I did begin therapy with Dr. A for depression and for assistance with an abusive relationship, which ended. However, I did continue therapy. I entered into a new relationship, and then we initiated marital counseling in 2017 with Dr. Adams. In November 2017, I did send the email posing the hypothetical question to Dr. A. And then their response to me was, I can report it if I need to. They never responded one way or another if they were required to report it. In January 2018, I did bring my daughter to Dr. A, and she spoke with both of us. My daughter disclosed many instances and different types of molestation by my ex-husband. after she disclosed that, she excused my daughter to the waiting room and talked to me one-on-one, told me that she did not believe that my daughter was being truthful, and she believed that her intentions were to try and break up my new marriage. I discontinued therapy with Dr. A, and I kicked my ex-husband out that same year. Our divorce wasn't finalized until 2020. That was just paperwork and money. But the same year I did end our marriage. It took me a few years finally healing and recovering from these experiences that I found the courage and clear-mindedness to see the truth of the situation and stand up and confront the people who hurt my daughter. And that is why I came forward with the complaint and to report the abuse to CPS. In September 2021, I reported the abuse to CPS, and I also filed a complaint against Dr. A to you, the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners. You should also be aware, which you are, that a former neighbor's daughter also reported similar abuse around the same time. I gave JM, I believe, the detective's contact information, and I'm more than happy to provide it to anyone to further this investigation. I believe I can also obtain contact for information for the other victim if you would require that. In summary, Dr. A is a mandatory reporter, I've learned, and she did not report the abuse that was disclosed to her multiple times. She had an ethical and legal responsibility to do so, and she did not. As a result of her actions or lack thereof, my daughter has needed the help of a psychologist to process and overcome issues caused by this abuse. But she refuses to go because of the trauma of not being believed or supported by Dr. A. And I would add myself at the time. I wish we lived in a world where abuse didn't exist. However, that is not the reality. So my hope is that every other person, that Dr. A and every other person in the position to help a victim does that. Report the abuse, support the victim. Thank you all for your time and attention. And I do believe that there are so many caring and ethical psychologists out there. And I truly appreciate the work that you do. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer, you're muted.
Thank you. Thank you, TW. We have a few follow-up questions. You said that there were more than one complaint. Was there more than one allegation of sexual abuse or other abuse towards your daughter by the ex-husband?
There was only one session that my daughter disclosed multiple instances. However, I disclosed it in subsequent sessions with her, and as well as I confronted my ex-husband in a session about the abuse as well with Dr. Adams.
So I read about the incident in the pool, but I didn't see any other allegations from the daughter.
Yes, I believe those are in my complaint. Do you want me to talk about those specifics?
Don't need a whole bunch of details, but yes, if you could share the
there was
and the report.
Dr. Meyer, I'm sorry, but I think this would be outside of the scope of the complaint. I mean, from a due process perspective, her complaint indicates only the pool issue. I would obviously have you defer to your legal counsel, but from a due process perspective, we haven't been given any notice about other allegations related to sexual abuse. And in fact, she did not put any of those in her complaint. So I'm a little concerned that this would violate our due process rights.
Ms. Galvin?
You're on mute, Ms. Galvin.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I too am looking through the documents and refer back to the complaint and only see the incident itemized in the complaint alleging the incident in the pool. So I would agree with Mr. Carey that he and his client have not been informed of any other instances that the board, that the complainant is alleging at this time.
Okay.
I don't know if the board feels that additional information is necessary, the complainant could amend her complaint and we could reschedule, or if you want to, you know, proceed on the information that you have at this time.
Dr. Davis Wilson, thoughts?
Can we go ahead and move to go into executive session for the purpose of legal advice?
Seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Sorry, can I say one thing real quick?
Yes, go ahead.
I did disclose during this complaint process that a report has been filed with the state police. So I don't know if I definitely have conducted an interview with them in detail, in more detail about the abuse. And I'll go back and look at my complaint and see if I didn't put those details in there, but I don't know if that can be considered as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's go ahead and move into executive session. All right, we are back. TW, could you share the are you alleging that you reported additional episodes of abuse to Dr. Adams prior to the end of your therapy with her in what, February 2018?
Yes.
Okay. Then I think we need to continue this case while we seek additional information, and Dr. Adams and her attorney are notified of any of that additional, those additional allegations as well.
And Chair Meyer, before the, may I have a moment to respond to the, to either TW or the board's decision to continue on this?
To me, yes.
All right. Thank you, Chair Meyer. The only thing I would say is I think it is extremely probative of the committee's review of this case that none of these supposed instances of additional abuse that were supposedly disclosed are in the initial complaint. And so while, you know, certainly I can't stop the board from continuing out a matter to get more information, I think the committee should definitely take into account the fact that this is a complainant who supposedly forgot instances of abuse that occurred, and also a complainant who did not include, according to her, did not include other instances of abuse. And it has an element of bootstrapping or attempting to rehabilitate a complaint that I feel is not well-founded. And I hope the board will take into context, we'll put this into context when it does return, that these are now, again, very late reports. We're now looking at several years. I also would note that there is a statute of limitations on the board. And so I certainly hope that there will be a level of information provided so the board can determine whether it's within the statute of limitations, because I don't believe it will be. And so I hope that this will be, all those items will be taken into account when evaluating these brand new allegations that are being made by this complainant.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Yes, we what we would like to do is request the police records, and TW, if you could attempt to get records from the police as well, we will also, but you may have better luck getting it since the investigation may be ongoing.
Yes.
And then we can proceed once we've received the additional information. Dr. Davis Wilson, any other requests or information you want?
No, Mr. Chair, I support the request for the actual police records, and that would be what we would be interested in reviewing if we can have access to those.
So, Ms. Michelson, if you could request those from the Phoenix Police. And so then we will go ahead and continue this case. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Ms. Galvin, do we need a motion to do anything, or we're just good with that and can move on?
You can move on.
All right, thank you. The next complaint to be discussed today is 3B, complaint number 2209, Karen Hawk. I'm also the lead on this case and will provide the committee with a summary. Okay. Dr. Hawk was issued her psychology license in 2019. She maintains a private practice in Gilbert, Arizona. The complainant RO and his ex-wife, mother, have been engaged in contentious custody proceedings since 2012 regarding their three minor children. A 2020 court order indicated that the parents agreed to joint legal decision making with the children primarily residing with mother and the complainant RO having a parenting time schedule. In 2020, daughter received therapy services from a court appointed safe haven therapist, Dr. Karen Schellick. And in September 2020, RO withdrew his consent for Dr. Schellick to treat daughter. In 2021, mother contacted Dr. Schellick to resume safe haven therapy, which RO objected to. Dr. Schellick gave notice to the court that she was withdrawing from the matter, and the parents subsequently agreed that daughter would be seen by Dr. Hawk. On May 20th, 2021, RO's 15-year-old daughter began therapy services that were not court-ordered with Dr. Hawk. Both parents signed consent forms for daughter's treatment. Between May and September of 2021, daughter participated in a total of 9 sessions with Dr. Hawk, which included 2 sessions with father that were virtual. On May 25th, 2021, shortly after daughter began therapy with Dr. Hawk, mother filed a petition to modify legal decision-making and parenting time. Dr. Hawk testified at an evidentiary hearing in family court on September 3rd, 2021, in response to a subpoena from mother's attorney. Following her testimony on September 16th, 2021, RO withdrew his consent for Dr. Hawk to treat the daughter. Approximately 2 weeks later, RO submitted a complaint against Dr. Hawk, alleging multiple issues. To include that RO's relationship with daughter went from normal to strained once daughter started therapy with Dr. Hawk. Dr. Hawk engaged in multiple private email communications with mother, which RO was not aware of until Dr. Hawk provided these communications to RO on October 6, 2021. Dr. Hawk testified as a witness for mother, claiming that RO and his wife, the stepmother, were emotionally abusive to daughter. Dr. Hawk failed to obtain the consent of both parents prior to sharing confidential information at the September 3rd hearing. Dr. Hawk's testimony, which was paid for by mother, further harmed the relationship between RO and daughter. Dr. Hawk barred RO from participating in therapy with daughter, yet allowed mother to continue. And Dr. Hawk failed to provide RO with daughter's treatment plan despite multiple requests. On October 29th, 2021, the court issued a ruling indicated that it is in the children's best interest for the parents to be awarded joint legal decision-making authority with mother and having final... For the parents to be awarded joint legal decision-making authority with mother having final decision-making authority. The ruling noted that the court found father's actions and interactions with Dr. Hawk prevented daughter from getting the proper counseling she needed. In December, the board received Dr. Hawk's response via her attorney, Mandy Carvis. Dr. Hawk submitted the daughter's clinical record and she reports that her treatment of daughter was appropriate, met the applicable standard of care, and was in compliance with applicable statutes and regulations. Dr. Hawk stated that RO is seeking to blame her for issues with daughter and decisions that were made by the court beyond her control. The relationship issues existed long before Dr. Hawk's involvement and were the primary issue that her services were sought out in the first place. Dr. Hawk explicitly informed the parents that she would not testify in court unless it was court-ordered or she received a subpoena. In this case, Dr. Hawk testified pursuant to a subpoena. She offered to write a treatment summary in lieu of testifying, which RO did not consent to. Both parents were informed in advance that Dr. Hawk had been issued a subpoena to testify at the hearing on September 3rd. RO scheduled an in-person session after he demanded that no one was to participate in daughter's treatment, to include himself. RO was fully aware of Dr. Hawk's participation in the court hearing and wanted to influence her opinion of his parenting as he was on his best behavior. Dr. Hawk summarized the daughter's treatment. Noting that court proceedings and custody issues had been ongoing since 2012. Both parents signed a consent form for daughter to receive treatment. Intake occurred on May 20th, 2021. First 30 minutes of the session were by daughter alone. Both parents joined for the last 30 minutes. It was evident that parents could not participate together in session without arguing. An initial treatment plan was developed. The plan was for parents to attend sessions as collateral participants, and they both signed a collateral consent form to support daughter and help with her treatment on an as-needed basis. In total, daughter received 9 sessions. 6 were individual without her parents and 3 sessions with RO present. Mother provided daughter's transportation to and from therapy appointments. Daughter was struggling with issues related to her parents and the relationship with RO and stepmother. Dr. Hawk, in response to the allegations, Dr. Hawk noted that she cannot control what information the parents chose to share with the court, nor when one of the parents' attorneys chooses to subpoena her to testify in court proceedings. Both parents were informed that she would be obligated to comply and testify. Throughout daughter's treatment, Dr. Hawk did her best to communicate with both parents in response to their questions about daughter's counseling. Both parents were copied on most of Dr. Hawk's emails, so there was no confusion about the information that was being shared. If one of the parents emailed Dr. Hawk separately, Dr. Hawk would typically respond by copying the other parent. Many of RO's emails to Dr. Hawk were threatening, accusatory, and demanding certain action with a designated due date. No matter what Dr. Hawk's response was, RO was unhappy with it. Mother provided Dr. Hawk with an audio recording and a copy of a text message in response to daughter attempting to jump out of stepmother's car. In the situation, Dr. Hawk weighed the benefits of keeping this information from RO, given the harm that he could potentially cause. She decided that protecting daughter from harm was important. RO did note that he was aware of that incident. Dr. Hawk states that the first time that RO requested a copy of the daughter's treatment plan was by email on September 13th, in which he gave Dr. Hawk 2 days to respond to his request. The treatment plan was not requested until RO decided to terminate therapy after the court hearing where Dr. Hawk testified. Dr. Hawk never encouraged daughter to run away or do anything unsafe. Rather, they discussed a safety plan in terms of what daughter could do if she felt like she was in an unsafe situation with our own stepmother, which she expressed to Dr. Hawk. When daughter informed Dr. Hawk that she attempted to jump out of a moving vehicle, Dr. Hawk reported the incident to DCS on 9/3/21, along with other concerns related to potential emotional abuse. Regarding the allegation that Dr. Hawk provided improper opinion testimony on September 3rd, Dr. Hawk believes that she responded appropriately to the questions asked by counsel. She had an adequate factual basis to offer testimony regarding possible emotional abuse of daughter by RO and stepmother. Dr. Hawk had the opportunity to directly observe RO's interactions with daughter, during which he continuously put her in the middle of his conflict with mother. This occurred several times despite Dr. Hawk warning RO about the harm to daughter's emotional well-being numerous times. And Dr. Hawk believes that the treatment she provided to daughter was appropriate, as was her interaction with the parents. She tried her best to work with RO and respond to his requests throughout her work with the daughter. And in an effort to improve her professional practice and conduct, Dr. Hawk sees monthly consultation from a forensic psychologist who has increased Dr. Hawk's working knowledge with high conflict and litigious families significantly. And that concludes my summary of the case.
We do have the complainant RO present, so we can go ahead and hear from him.
Thank you. RO, please state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Okay, thank you. I'm RO. I appreciate the opportunity to address the board today. As you can imagine, what I'm about to say is deeply personal to me. There are many important and relevant details that I would like to share, but will not have the time here today. I will attempt to provide a brief summary of my complaint. I hope the board will seek clarification and subsequently asking questions or seeking documentation that will provide insight and clarity into a very complex situation. After repeatedly asking for a treatment plan over a 4-month period, Dr. H failed to refused to provide one, repeatedly stating that my daughter, a 15-year-old, knows what she needs in therapy. Dr. Hawk had been discussing a safety plan in therapy with my daughter and later testified under oath that she never put it in writing. Dr. H's discussion of a safety plan with my daughter involved my daughter jumping out of a second story window and running somewhere to find a phone, which is inappropriate and unsafe for a minor. Dr. H communicated confidential information via email that occurred during therapy, which was later used by my daughter's mother as exhibits in the September 3rd, 2021 hearing on custody and legal decision making. It should be noted that my ex-wife has filed approximately 20 petitions in family court over the last 5 years, and has repeatedly sought sole legal decision-making and to limit my parenting time. The continuing conflict between the parents and constant court filings were paired with my ex-wife directly involving our daughter in the details and outcomes of each case. This was a known issue to our previous parenting coordinator and to our daughter's previous therapist. During the same time, my ex-wife was also actively characterizing and referring to me and my wife in unpleasant and derogatory ways to my children. When I voiced my concern of these things to Dr. Hawk, she threatened to block my email address. Dr. H then barred me from participating in therapy with my daughter, brought me in for two sessions and then barred me again. It was never clear who was the patient in the therapy, my daughter and I, or the whole family. The whole time, my daughter was being withheld from me. Dr. H was meeting alone with my ex-wife after almost each in-person therapy session with my daughter, which greatly assisted my ex-wife in building a custody case against me. Dr. H then accepted payment from my ex-wife to testify as an expert witness, stating that my current wife and I were emotionally abusive, even though she had only met me twice and never met or even talked to my wife. Without any testing or other evaluation, Dr. H characterized my wife in court as aggressive, abusive, and controlling, and me as difficult and abusive. After 80 days of not seeing my daughter and her numerous sessions with Dr. H during that time, my daughter's relationship with me went from normal to very strained. My daughter started having irrational fears and panic attacks that she never had before and that were greatly driven by Dr. H's validation of my ex-wife's views of me and my wife. Furthermore, all information discussed in therapy was confidential. In order to release this information, Dr. H should have obtained the consent of both parents as we shared joint legal decision-making. Dr. Hawk failed to obtain my consent before she shared confidential information at a September 3rd, 2021 custody hearing. After filing this complaint, I also discovered that Dr. H had been receiving emails from my ex-wife with direct instruction to not inform me of my daughter's state, suggesting that I would harm my daughter. And Dr. H chose to follow this instruction based solely on my ex-wife's suggestion. I requested the therapy records and expected their timely disclosure. However, it took Dr. H over 3.5 months to provide them. After reviewing them, I found several contradictions, including substantial discrepancies in Dr. H's previous statements and emails, all of which made me suspect that these notes were either created after I requested them and the therapy sessions were over, or that they had been modified for the purpose of defending my complaint. I requested a print screen of the properties of the PDF file that I was sent from Dr. H's attorney to clarify my suspicion and received no response. These are additional examples of continuing unethical behavior and inaccurate record keeping, which I would have included in my original complaint, but could not do so due to inappropriate disclosure. After reviewing APA guiding principles of practice, it is clear to me that Dr. H has violated the principles of beneficence and non-maleficence, fidelity and responsibility, and justice. Furthermore, she is engaged in conflict of interest, did not maintain confidentiality, violated rules of disclosure and basis for assessment, and did not adhere to guidelines involving couples or families. These violations have resulted in my daughter having more issues to deal with than she did prior to therapy with Dr. H. Thank you.
Thank you, Aro. And I believe the committee has a few questions for you. And I'll go ahead and start with that. In reviewing the emails, I saw a lot of questions about what the treatment plan was going to include, that you sent questions to Dr. Hawk. I never saw a request for any records until September. Did I miss something? Were those requests done verbally? Can you specify? No.
I explicitly asked multiple times for a treatment plan. I understand that that's important to establish, you know, the issues, the goals, and the basis by, you know, what those goals are based on and how we're going to achieve the goals. And so that was requested multiple times via email.
Okay, so you...
And September 16th was... Or when I submitted on September 13th, that was the last attempt that I was going to give her to actually send a treatment plan.
So your prior requests for the treatment plan were by email?
Yes.
Okay. And then after Dr. Hawk received a subpoena to testify in court, Did she seek a consent to release information from you?
No.
And once you were notified that she was planning on testifying, did you at that point state you did not give permission for her to release information?
I thought that that was obvious, that if parents have joint legal decision making, that any confidential information needs to be approved.
Okay. Those were only my only questions. Thank you. Dr. Davis Wilson, did you have any questions?
I do not.
Okay. Thank you, Aro. And Dr. Hawk, if you could please introduce yourself. And let's see, are you represented? Yes. And Ms. Carvis, if you could introduce yourself.
Yes. Good morning, Dr. Meyer, members of the board. My name is Mandy Carvis of Wicker Smith, and I'm appearing with and on behalf of Dr. Hawk, who is also present this morning. Dr. Hawk, would you introduce yourself?
Dr. Hawk, you're on mute. Can you please unmute your end?
Yes, my name is KH, and I am the psychologist of the client in question.
Thank you. Do either of you have a brief statement that you would like to make?
Yes, Dr. Meyer, members of the board, I would like to briefly make a statement, and then Dr. Hawk would be happy to answer any questions that you or any other members of the board have. As this board knows, dealing with families and contentious divorce and custody proceedings is a difficult undertaking. Dr. Hawk did her best under the circumstances involved in this family situation. It was not until after she was already engaged in this setting that she learned about the prior involvement of the court-appointed family therapist and RO's decision to terminate that therapy. So things got understandably a little more complicated after she was involved. She did, however, seek to appropriately communicate with both parents. If one parent reached out to her individually, she would loop the other parent back in. She did communicate with mother sometimes with respect to scheduling issues, but nothing substantive other than the one safety-related situation, which Dr. Hawk appropriately reported after she was informed of that. With respect to her testimony in family court, she had informed both parents that she would not testify and she would not do that absent receipt of a subpoena. When she did receive a subpoena, she informed both parents appropriately. Neither of them, via themselves or via their attorney, sought to quash or object to that. And both attorneys, including RO's attorney, extensively questioned Dr. Hawk at the hearing. Therefore, we contend that that was an implied consent to her testimony. There was no attempt to preclude her from testimony at that hearing. Unfortunately, providers never know what questions they're going to be asked. She was there in the capacity of a treating provider, not in the capacity of an expert. She did her best to respond to questions that she was asked at that time. Subsequent to this, as an issue to avoid such an issue in the future, Dr. Hawk has developed an ROI form that she requires both parents to sign prior to testimony, even if she is subpoenaed, so that there will be no doubt as to that. As to the decisions that were made by the family court, Dr. Hawk obviously cannot control what a family court judge decides. As Dr. Meyer pointed out, RO provided all of the email communication, as did Dr. Hawk. We also never saw a specific written request for a treatment plan until after the decision to terminate treatment was made and this complaint was filed. And with respect to response to that request, it was done after the complaint was filed and Dr. Hawk engaged counsel. As such, we were focused on providing a response to the board and then ultimately also I provided a copy of all of the records to RO directly. In response to that, RO asked why it took so long and then requested a print screen of the records to show when they were created, essentially an audit trail. That is not something that is required to be produced. There is no such allegation prior to that about alteration of records. It would be highly unusual in order to be required to provide such a thing. Again, Dr. Hawk has voluntarily sought out the consultation of a forensic psychologist on a monthly basis to work with them and workshop and discuss these types of issues and cases so that she can be better engaged in the future. She's also looked into some coursework in that regard, ordered some publications in that regard, but has also doing some more in-depth things in the intake process to identify situations that are in fact high conflict and identifying providers who more specialize in that area so that she could appropriately refer them. We believe that her communication with this family and her involvement with this child was appropriate. She did everything that she could in order to communicate with everyone about what was going on. She did not voluntarily appear in court. She appeared pursuant to a subpoena that was not objected to. She is happy to address any questions or concerns that members of the committee have. And she's happy to address any questions that you might have. We appreciate the opportunity to be heard today.
Thank you, Ms. Carvis. Before we begin questioning with Dr. Hawk, I'd like to make a motion to go into executive session for the purposes of receiving legal advice. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We'll now move into executive session. All right. It looks like we are all back. Ms. Carvis, thank you for your statement. Dr. Hawk, we do have a few questions for you. I'm wondering if you can talk about the distinction between a subpoena that originates from an attorney versus a bench subpoena or one ordered by a judge, and the requirements for breaking confidentiality based on those different types of subpoenas. What type of subpoena was this that you received to testify?
So I'm not really sure. This was definitely not court ordered. This was coming from the mother's attorney.
Okay. Yeah. Are you required to release information based on an attorney submitted subpoena?
No. Well, what I'm required to do is I need to respond to the subpoena, but if one parent decides not to consent, then I have to go back to the attorney who originated the subpoena to try to find out if I can be dismissed from testifying or whether this will become a court order. And if it is court order, then I have to appear.
Okay. Yeah. So did you request a release from both parents to testify?
I did not necessarily request a release to testify. I did communicate in the email that I sent to both parents that I was subpoenaed, and if they had any concerns about the subpoena or me testifying, that they needed to inform me of their concerns. But I did not necessarily request consent, which I do now, by the way. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, typically if I'm going to release information, I am the one responsible for obtaining a release from the controlling party to disclose that information. And I'm hearing what you said is you put the burden on them to notify you if you shouldn't release it, as opposed to actively seeking a release from the parents?
Go ahead. Yes. Yeah, which I now have that. I ask for signed releases now. Even though they may consent verbally, I have it now in writing to release information.
Okay.
And I think additionally, Dr. Meyer, again, both parents were represented by counsel. Counsel for both RO was provided with a copy of the subpoena, and there's a process within the subpoena document that was provided to the board as part of the response about a mechanism for objecting to a subpoena. There was no objection lodged either with the family court or specifically with Dr. Hawk saying, I don't want you to testify. And both attorneys actively participated in questioning her at the family court hearing. And to my knowledge, there was no objection asserted at the time of that hearing to the testimony. In terms of what kind of subpoena it was or if it was a court order, I believe Dr. Hawk is correct that there wasn't a specific order from the court to testify, but it was a legal subpoena that she had an obligation to comply with, and upon receipt of that, she did notify both of them. And again, they both, RO's attorney had a mechanism to object to the testimony, either to Dr. Hawk or to the court directly, and did not do so, to my knowledge.
RO, this is a time for us to question the other party. The second question is, when you were emailing back and forth with RO, are those emails encrypted?
I use my Gmail account. So whatever the encryption controls, no, they weren't. I did not use a special encrypted communication, no.
Okay.
For emails.
Is Gmail email considered confidential or secure?
They have their own. Yeah, I think they have their own security method. However, no, I like I said, I didn't make sure that I don't have a specific program via Gmail that would allow me to encrypt them. No, but whatever guidelines Gmail uses.
Okay. And I noticed in your informed consent form that you do talk about emails and other electronic communication, but it sounded like it was implied unless the client actively notified you, then they were consenting to non-secure communication electronically. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ever discuss that with the parents?
I did not verbally discuss that. No, it was in my consent form. Yeah. We didn't, I didn't highlight it. Yeah.
Okay. And then when did you start seeking monthly consultation with another forensic psychologist?
In March of 2021.
Okay. Do you keep any records of that? Are there consultations?
I have receipts. Yeah, I have an invoice and a summary of what we discussed. We actually talked about the emails because I was concerned about the encryption and all that. And the forensic psychologist said it's that he doesn't have an encrypted email either. So it's something that I think I'm going to adopt in the future. Yes. But we did talk about it in consultation.
Okay. Those were all of my questions. Thank you, Dr. Hawk. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
I think that you addressed my questions, and I guess the only follow-up I would have regarding the email and the encryption, just to clarify, you have not changed that practice. So you've added the ROI for circumstances such as a single party initiation of a subpoena, but you have not adopted any changes in...
Yeah, I actually have an encrypted, I actually have a special Microsoft subscription to an encryption via a different email, which is karenhawk@rca.llc. But in terms of the RO and I and the family, I used Gmail. So I did not use that encryption because a lot of times people can't even open the encrypted email. So it was very cumbersome to use that, but I have had that implemented for a very long time. And I sometimes use it when people are able to open it, but sometimes I don't. So I'm not consistent with it. Because like I said, some people can't even open the Microsoft encrypts the emails. It all depends what kind of browser that they have or, yeah.
And when you don't have the encryption, is there any specific reason why you moved to a personal Gmail instead of just continuing to use the non-encrypted organization email?
You mean the encrypted, like the Microsoft? I buy a special program for encrypted email via Microsoft.
Right.
And I use a different email address. Go ahead.
Right. So, but Microsoft, the encryption can turn on and off. So I was just wondering why you then used personal email if they were unable to open the encryption, and what steps you normally take to make that decision. Because oftentimes when we're sending unencrypted emails, the key to that is to make sure we're just not sharing any PHI or treatment or therapy related information. So we can use unencrypted emails.
Yeah.
It's just that the encryption's required when discussing treatment planning, therapeutic information, PHI, and so Microsoft has the ability to turn that on and off. What makes you, or what do you use as then criteria to switch from the company email to then a personal email?
Typically, if people can't open the Microsoft encrypted emails, when they just have difficulty. Oh, you mean you're telling me that I can actually turn it on and turn it off? And why don't I stick to Microsoft and my karenhawk@rca.llc?
Yeah, you are able to turn that on and off. So that might be something that you want to look into. And then again, the turning it on and off and the criteria, I would definitely, I think that the concern is that, yeah, we can talk to other colleagues about how they do their practice, but the HIPAA and the transmission of electronic data, like that's more of a like legal consult type of question versus asking a peer how they do it. Because simply saying that, hey, well, these other peers, they don't encrypt theirs, doesn't make it legally, the correct approach when it comes to things such as HIPAA and other considerations.
Dr. Wilson, just for my own edification, because I've obviously dealt with this board for quite some time, and I've almost every case I've had has had emails. I'm not specifically aware of any provision that actually requires an encrypted email. Is there a statute or a regulation? Because I can just say, I, as an attorney, I have obviously a work email and I communicate with clients all the time, and it's not, I'm not aware of any specific HIPAA requirement that it be encrypted, as long as you're ensuring that the information is only going to the intended recipient, which is what occurred here. So if there's something specific that you could point Dr. Hawk to with respect to the requirement of encryption, that would be helpful so that she could review that.
Yeah, and that's in the HIPAA, the high tech standards of HIPAA. So what is that, high tech standards of 1995 or what have you? In all of the correspondence beyond that, it's only specific in sharing. So you don't have to have encryption all of the time. It's in the specifics of sharing PHI and or anything related to the therapeutic services as it pertains to PHI, if transmitted electronically, has to be protected. But if you're sharing scheduling, other correspondence, or saying, hey, let's get on the phone and talk about this, none of those things have to be. It's just the protection related to the actual therapeutic records.
Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that.
And that's why with Microsoft, I recommend working with them to figure out how to turn it on and off. Because then you're able to have scheduling and all of, because it's hard. Some emails and some systems, because there's so many ways to get through the system, some people can't access it. And the solution to that generally then is to just not disclose information related to records therapy, PHI, via email at that point. It could be sending an email and saying, again, let's schedule a phone call or do some other means. It's that electronic transmission.
Okay.
That was the only questions and comments, I suppose, that I had.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. RO, did you have something you wanted to follow up with?
I do. Thank you. I just wanted to point out a couple things of, conflicting information. When I actually did receive Dr. Hawk's records for my daughter, there are a lot of dates in there that don't really line up. On August 20th notes, she states that she made a call to DCS that day, and then later says she made a call on September 3rd, the same day of the hearing. I feel like Dr. Hawk's trying to frame, the treatment plan in such a way that is not honest. If you look at the treatment plan, it has a date on there of May 20th, which was the first day that my daughter had a session with Dr. Hawk. If you look at the email record, that treatment plan was actually sent in September of 2021. So after I had repeatedly asked for it, her signature is also there on the date of May 20th, 2021, which I don't understand how, you generate a treatment plan on the same day that you have an intake session with a patient. My signature is obviously not there because it was never provided. Regarding the subpoena, my attorney, if Dr. Hawk's attorney has record of that subpoena being provided to my attorney or myself, I'd love to see it, because I've never seen that subpoena. And I don't believe my attorney had either. So there was never really, an official chance to object, because there was no document provided. And I did repeatedly ask Dr. Hawk not to share confidential, sensitive information via email, especially given the history of our very contentious court proceedings, because I understand she doesn't know much about the situation, which is why I was trying to bring it to light, but those things will be used. And it's really unfortunate that.
I'm going to stop you here. I just wanted to see if you had any direct responses to her. Is there anything else that.
To Dr. Hawk?
No. Okay, I think we're going to move on now. Thank you for sharing. I'm just hearing the same thing that you had previously said. So this is, we're now going to, the committee will now move into deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys. And I'll go ahead and begin the deliberation. I do see potential issues here with not maintaining confidentiality of records, both with not having a consent to release information from RO to testify, as well as the lack of encryption or security with the emails. There's substantial personal health information in those emails going back and forth. I was very concerned when I read those. In regards to whether a release was needed from RO to testify, I'm not positive, and I do think we need some additional consultation or expertise from an expert on that.
Yeah, Dr. Meyer, I agree. And in these particular cases, I'm, you know, representing more of the public, and I do have very similar concerns about the exchange of information and kind of the policies and processes around protecting PHI, both in response to the subpoena, but also in other correspondence with the parties. You know, one option that we could have is to go ahead and just refer this to the full board for further review, but seek an outside consultant to perhaps weigh in on some of the forensic nature of this particular case and see if we can get some feedback that clarifies some of the questions that we have.
Okay. As far as any potential violations, did you have concerns about the treatment plan or the dates and lack of signatures on the treatment plan?
I do, as far as it does appear through multiple emails that there was a request, maybe not specifically for a written treatment plan, but a request for some sort of acknowledgement of what is the plan? What are the outcomes? What is the treatment? What is this going to look like? And there was some email correspondence too as well regarding, you know, it takes 12 or so sessions to get to know a family, to be able to develop those things, of which it looks like RO acknowledged and then said, okay, we've gotten those sessions done now. So what's the next steps? What's the goals of treatment? And I think treatment plans can come in multiple ways. Yes, we have them in writing, and that's ideal in clinical standard and what have you. But when you also have, you know, a guardian of a patient saying, hey, what is the goal of treatment or what are we doing? I think that those are valid questions that is, if I were a parent, I would want to have answered as well. And I don't know that that was acknowledged clearly through the process. And then as far as the treatment plan itself, I will defer to you as kind of the psychologist of what your guys' standards of care for kind of the, you know, signing and completion timelines and those sorts of things.
I mean, there's so many differences between different electronic health records, but I do have some concerns with just the statement on the treatment plan that where is it electronic signature on file, but we apparently have the whole file and there's no indication of that. There's a place for it to be signed, and really that should be signed by both parents, and I'm not seeing that. And then the date of 5/20/21 for the signature does not line up with the progress notes of that treatment plan being completed by them. So,
and I do agree. It appears that the email I was referring to about RO asking for, hey, you know, I'm wondering what the plan is with treatment, that was dated, I believe, in August.
Right. So to have that treatment plan indicating that at least a parent had signed it by the 20th just doesn't seem accurate. So the possible violations here. Sorry, just a second. That I see are16H, failing or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial or professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided to a client or patient. And then failing to obtain a client, 16R, failing to obtain a client's or patient's informed and written consent to release personal or otherwise confidential information to another party, unless the release is otherwise authorized by law. And I think that's it. Would those be the two that you see, Dr. Davis Wilson, or anything else?
No, I'm in agreement with those two.
All right, so I would make a motion to move the complaint to the full board for investigation of possible violations of let's try this again. ARS 32-2061, 16H, and R.
Dr. Meyer, is there anything in the code as far as it relates to DD that would be relevant here?
I guess we could look at the confidentiality in the ethics code as well, which is what
Jennifer Heidi has a site.
It'd be 4.01
and 0.05.
Well, and and 0.02 as well, I think. I'm a little concerned about the informed consent form of just saying you're agreeing to looser standards of confidentiality without an active opt-in to that, to just say hopefully you caught this when you're reading all these forms and let me know if you want me to actually maintain confidentiality standards. I think that's concerning. So
I agree. I think, you know, at least it, from my experience, the standards of practice would be to have that high standard. And if there is continuous, you know, concerns with not being able to access encryption or whatever, then you can look at an opt out for some of those standards. But as an opt out as a standard with no option for going in, I do have concerns with that as well.
So that would be DD 4.0102 and 05. And then with record keeping, I think 6.01, documentation of professional work and maintenance of records, would also fit in.
And just so we're covering everything possible, so there's adequate notice, would all be a possibility here.
So that was a motion, correct?
Yeah. In regards to Ms. Galvin's question about O, I don't know that. Fits necessarily.
Okay. And that's fine. I just wanted to ensure that. Yeah. So right now we have HRDD as it relates to 4.01, 02, 05, and 6.01.
Yes. So that would be my motion to move it to the full board for investigation of possible violations for those mentioned, as well as to request that staff seek out a forensic psychologist to provide a consultation to the board about standards of practice for responding to subpoenas and requirements for release of information.
And I'll second that.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion carries. Thank you all for being here, and staff will follow up with you on next steps.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
We will move on to agenda item 3C. And which is complaint number 22-10 for Dr. Janet Ranney. Dr. Davis Wilson, you're the lead. Would you provide a brief overview of the complaint?
Yes. So from June to September of 2021, complainants BE participated in individual therapy with Dr. Ranney via private pay. He did choose to terminate treatment in September of 2021. On October 13th, 2021, he filed a complaint against Dr. Rani, alleging several issues, some of those involving Dr. Rani, an accusation that Dr. Rani inappropriately interrogated him about disability benefits, that she invited her, that she invited him to her home for sessions, that there were many inaccuracies and inconsistencies across the documentation, that there was an attempt to change a diagnosis that was previously rendered to a new diagnosis, that the individual did not feel that diagnosis was valid or appropriate, and that Dr. Rani recommended that the individual stop a medication regimen prescribed by another physician or by a physician. The payment of services were a point of contention and concern at the onset of services. One of the issues expressed was that many individuals, once the complainant disclosed a prior diagnosis, that many doctors did not return phone calls or engage services. Dr. Rani was comfortable moving forward with the services that were provided, but the complainant alleges that shortly after seeing Dr. Rani, Dr. Rani did change her scope of practice on the website as to not include those concerns. Dr. Rani did respond back to the board in a timely fashion. Dr. Rani addressed the concerns, stating that she was offering to assist. She provided documentation related to the sessions provided. She did clarify that she did conduct a pre-screening prior to engaging in services, and felt that the individual was stable and could benefit from the services that she had experience in providing. She did also note that there was not a change in diagnosis, but rather that the treatment that she was providing better fit the DSM criteria for a secondary condition. And I think that's Dr. Rani does state that while the stigma of the disability benefits were a point of discussion through the sessions, it was initiated by the complainant, and she helped troubleshoot through options as to ways that can be improved, or that he could seek alternatives to his concerns related to the disability services being provided, and disability assistance. And she does state that she did not tell the individual that the diagnosis goes away. She did not ask for specifics about the individual's finances or budgets or disability status. And that he did often become angry or upset if they did discuss any of those topics. And let's see, I believe that, she states that she did not invite the complainant to her home. She does have a home office with a separate entrance, and that after vaccines were available, some clients did choose to come to the home office for sessions if they were vaccinated. And I believe that concludes. State that she did not at any point recommend that the individual come off the medications, and that at each session she did ask for a status on the medications and whether or not the individual was following the medication regimen. And that concludes my summary.
Just to note, Dr. Meyer, I did receive an email from the complainant, BE, yesterday. He indicated that he would not be participating today, so we can go ahead and hear from Dr. Rainey and her attorney, Mr. Hover.
Good morning. Charlie Hover, counsel for Dr. Rainey. Thank you for the summary. Thank you for the work put into investigating the complaint by Ms. Michelson. I think that the summaries are both quite accurate and tell the story in a cogent manner. I won't repeat anything that Dr. Rainey has said in her response, nor that was summarized. I would point out that I believe when all is taken into consideration that there is insufficient evidence of any violation of this board's statutes, rules, or codes of ethics. I think that that statement that I just made can be seen in Dr. Rainey's very eloquent defense that she submitted in response to the complaint. I think you can find the defense for Dr. Rainey in her excellent notes. And I think the complainant himself has provided to this board information which it should take very seriously when considering the legitimacy of his complaints. I refer the board to statements made to Dr. Rainey by the complainant only weeks before he filed his complaint. In his email to her canceling his sessions, he stated specifically, "Thank you for all the work we've been doing together the past few months." His stated reason for stopping the therapy was financial issues, and that he felt he needed a different style of therapy. There was no complaint about the therapy that she was providing. There was no complaint to her about anything that he subsequently complained to the board. And he concluded that email with, "Thank you again for all our work together. Maybe, depending on how things turn out, maybe I can reach out to you in the future." Clearly, at that time, he had no complaints about Dr. Rainey as he subsequently brought them forward to the board and had not expressed those in either that letter or in person. He followed up that email the next day. "I did learn a lot from you. I especially found how helpful you broke down problems into parts and how you helped debunk some of my distorted thoughts about people and their motives, for example. I also learned a great deal about how trauma of the past affects my daily life and the brain processes that accompany that, etc." He concluded, "Also, I'm sorry for the seemingly abrupt cancellation. I knew I could only do this medium term, but was planning to give notice by the end of October or November, but I had some worries about paying my property taxes this month, and by January, I have to start paying on my student loans again." Again, we have a conclusion from him. "I would consider contacting you again in the future for therapy when my financial circumstances change, if that's okay. It's traditionally very difficult for me to choose a provider since I'm very critical of people and especially providers. I felt comfortable with you for the most part and think your fees were fair, which enabled me to have some quality care for a while. So thank you for everything. I appreciate the time and effort you put into helping me and the update on my health." Finally, with regard to the accuracy of the notes, which he complains about, in an email on September 28th, after he had received and reviewed those very notes he now complains of, he wrote back to Dr. Rainey, "Thanks so much for your notes, etc. I read everything word for word for all weeks to the last day, and everything looks perfect. I also appreciate your recommendation for future treatment. Good luck to you and your support. Best of luck to you." Ladies and gentlemen, I think that belies a lot of what the complainant subsequently brought forward to the board. And I think objectively, if you look at the notes and you look at Dr. Rainey's explanation, I don't think there's any other conclusion than that there is insufficient evidence to carry this matter forward for full board review. And we ask that it be dismissed at this stage. Thank you. Dr. Rainey is available for questions. If she would turn off her mute, she could answer them for you.
Thank you, Mr. Hover. And Dr. Rainey, could you just introduce yourself for the record?
Hi, I'm Janet Rainey, clinical psychologist.
Thank you. Dr. Davis-Wilson, any questions for Dr. Rainey?
I do not. I did want to note as well that Dr. Rainey did also address in her response to the board the reasoning for changing the scope of practice on the website. She has been a psychologist for many years and has chosen to limit some of her practice to areas in which she wants to continue to practice, which I think is, you know, within what's allowable for a psychologist to do when defining their scope of practice. I did not see any concerns with that specific component of the complaint. And so I wanted to make sure that it was on the record as well that that the doctor did respond to that component of the complaint as well. I have no questions for the doctor.
Nor do I. So the committee will now begin deliberation. Time to discuss the case without interruptions from others. Dr. Davis-Wilson, would you like to begin the deliberation?
Yeah, as stated earlier, on these particular cases, I am more of a public party interest. And based on the documentation provided, the information shared with us by both parties, the nature of the complaint, the documentation relating to treatment, I don't see any concerns with what the doctor has provided. And I would move that we dismiss this complaint.
Okay. The one, for the most part, I thought the progress notes looked good. The one kind of bit of feedback I wanted to provide is that when the client requested that changes be made to the record, it doesn't have to be conflictual, that you don't have to change your, perspective or, any of the information, but what you can do is add to the note that the client contested this, that the client disagreed with this. You don't have to change your opinions, or professional, perspective, but you can at least, it doesn't have to be as confrontational as what this seemed, to come back and say through your attorney, say that you disagree and you're not going to change anything. You can just make a note that the client contested this and here's what they thought, rather than just refusing to acknowledge their concerns. That being said, that's not a violation, and I didn't really have any other concerns. So I would second the motion to dismiss. All in favor say aye. Sorry.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Rainey and Mr. Hover, for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we will move on to Agenda 3D. Complaint to be discussed is case number 2208 for Dr. Alicia Garcia. Dr. Davis-Wilson, you're the lead. Would you provide a brief overview?
Yes. the complainant, MG, and her ex-husband have been in contentious custody proceedings since 2004 regarding their minor child. Since the divorce, the child has lived with the mother, and father has had supervised visitation with the son. And in 2011, father began seeing Dr. Garcia for individual therapy. There was a variety of diagnoses that the individual was seeking treatment for. To date, it is our understanding that the individual still seeks treatment from Dr. Garcia, though it is noted as infrequently. In 2014, Dr. Garcia wrote a letter at the father's request outlining his progress in treatment. And in 2020, Dr. Garcia wrote a second letter at the father's request as he had petitioned the court to allow for supervised visits with the son. In the letter, Dr. Garcia indicated that it was her professional opinion that the father is able to have unsupervised visits with the son. And a copy of that letter has been provided to us. Dr. Garcia did testify in court at the request of the father's attorney. The father's last session at that point had occurred in April of 2021. Testified again that father should have visitation with the son. Sorry, I lost my little spot here. Through the investigation, it's also noted that in 2016, another letter was provided, also documenting that father's progress in treatment was good and that it was the belief of the psychologist that there was no reason to restrict visitation with son, as there was not any evidence to support that he was of harm to son. The licensee did respond to the board's complaint. Dr. Garcia did acknowledge that she's been providing therapy for the individual since 2011, after he was referred by another physician. The doctor began treating the father prior to marriage, and then continued as the divorce was finalized and through and was treating the father through some of the times in which he the times in which the father had supervised visits with the son. Following the divorce, Dr. Garcia continued to treat the father, and they did maintain a trusting relationship. MG and the father continued to litigate matters of custody, and Dr. Garcia did acknowledge that she did request that the father's attorney did request her to write a letter detailing the status of therapy and treatment progress, of which she did provide to them. She does acknowledge that she did testify for the father about the father's treatment during a modification hearing. She does not recall everything that was stated, but generally provided information regarding father's treatment frequency, compliance with treatment recommendations, overall stability and behavior and treatment progress. A supplemental response to staff's questions. So staff did ask additional questions to the licensee. A supplemental response was provided and has been made available to us regarding the testimony and continuing education, which has also been provided to us as well. And that concludes my summary of this matter.
And Dr. Meyer, we do have the complainant MG on the phone, so we can go ahead and hear from her first.
Thank you. MG, please state your initials for the record, and this is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes to add to anything that was not in the summary.
Dr. Meyer, if I may, there is some substantial medical information provided to us as a part of the original complaint. Can we ask the complainant if she is going to provide or needs to discuss anything related to the diagnoses specifically or the PHI that we would need to go into executive session?
Yes, thank you for that clarification. So, MG, did you follow that? If you want to talk about any diagnosis or any medical records, then we need to move into a more confidential hearing. And MG, are you here? If so, please state your initials.
Shows that her end is unmuted.
Yeah. MG, we're not hearing anything from you.
MG, could you possibly try hanging up and calling back in?
Ms. Michelson, do you have contact information for MG? Could you?
Yeah, I can try calling her. She does have the Zoom link, but give me a moment.
Okay. Just with her having logged in, I want to give her an opportunity to speak. Why don't we take a brief recess while we're trying to contact her? So let's start back up at 10:35, and hopefully we will have MG with us. Back. So let's resume. MG, this is an... please introduce yourself with your initials only, and this is an opportunity for you to... provide a brief statement if you would like, keeping in mind that any information about specific medical information or diagnoses should not be shared in this meeting, but we can go into a confidential executive session if you do need to share that information.
Thank you, sir. My initials are MG, and I had some concerns with Dr. Garcia, I'm sorry, Dr. G, testifying in this very long extended case with a very deep history of mental health, where my ex-husband has had to have specifically only court-ordered supervised visitation, whereas he's several times tried to amend those court orders to gain unsupervised access. Where Dr. G has twice testified that in her professional opinion, my ex-husband should have unsupervised access to the child. However, it was our belief that under testimony, given her professional opinion, she based this off of a six-time visit with my ex-husband, not ever having observed him with my son, who is 8 years old, has his own psychiatric diagnoses. It's testified under oath that, I mean, my ex-husband has a loving relationship with my child, that they do well together, however, has never observed him with my child over the past 7-8 years that he's been under supervised visitation, has never reached out to the supervisor herself, who's been with us for 5 years, to discuss situations. She was not, she testified that she was not aware of dangerous situations that had happened even as late as this past summer. And it was our belief that she just didn't do her due diligence enough to make a professional opinion under oath in court that could potentially place my child at emotional, physical, or psychological harm. And it has since been ordered by the judge and by a court-ordered advisor that supervision continue at this time for an unspecified period of time, that my ex-husband still displays psychological and psychiatric harm potentially to my child. And so that was why I had filed the complaint, because and I don't know if Dr. G worked within her scope of practice without to make that professional opinion about the relationship between my child and my ex-husband and his ability to be able to parent without having spoken to any other individual involved in the case.
All right. Thank you, MG.
But I also add, sir, I'm sorry that in the past, my ex-husband has also been found incompetent by the court system. So that was another concern, that if the court system had found him incompetent, why now was he, was Dr. Garcia giving her professional opinion that he should now be able to parent my child unsupervised?
Okay, thank you. Dr. Davis-Wilson, do you have any questions for the complainant?
I do not.
Okay. Nor do I. MG, thank you for being here.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Dr. Garcia, if you and Ms. Stark could introduce yourselves, and then this would be an opportunity to make a brief statement.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. This is Sarah Stark, and I'm counsel for Dr. Garcia.
I'm Alicia Garcia. I'm a licensed psychologist.
Thank you. Do you have a statement that you would like to make?
Yes, I'll just make a brief statement, and then I'll turn it over to any questions that you may have for Dr. Garcia. I wanted to point out as an initial matter that we have not received a copy of the hearing transcript, and I don't believe that was provided with the complaint. So any of the specific quotes that complainant may have referenced in her opening, I think it would be unfair to really dive into those without, substantiating that that was actually said at the hearing. As a general rule, Dr. Garcia and her office staff maintain screening procedures and typically do not take on new clients who are in the midst of high conflict family and custody proceedings. Dr. Garcia's client is complainant's ex-husband. Dr. Garcia began seeing her client over 10 years ago, prior to him being married to complainant. It was not reasonably foreseeable at the time that this individual would later be involved in a contentious divorce and custody situation. As has been stated in our written response, Dr. Garcia was contacted by her client's attorney by phone in advance of the September 2021 modification hearing. He indicated that he wanted her to testify as a fact witness about the work her client had been doing in therapy and how he had been progressing. He further stated that she could come on her own volition or that he would subpoena her testimony. Dr. Garcia was not working in her office at that time due to COVID, and she was hesitant to give out her home address, and she therefore agreed to testify without a subpoena. As I stated previously, she does not recall in detail everything that she testified to at the hearing and has not read or received a copy of the transcript from that day. However, as a general matter, she recognizes that it is outside of the scope of her role as her client psychologist to provide opinions on reunification and custody. If she is required or subpoenaed to provide an opinion in a legal proceeding, such as the one that took place, or in connection with the legal proceedings, such as in the form of a letter, she should testify only regarding her work with the client and his or her progress in therapy. Further, she should ensure to qualify statements in her testimony or written statement with the fact that she is only providing the information based on the work she has done with the client. This complaint has caused Dr. Garcia a great amount of distress. She has practiced for over 20 years without incident or discipline. As a result of this complaint, she has reassessed her practice and has taken further action by updating her informed consent to indicate she does not provide forensic or investigative work or legal testimony. She has also completed 6 hours of continuing education and risk management. Based on her understanding of the mistakes that she may have made in this case and her willingness and efforts to mitigate future risks of this nature, we would respectfully request that the committee dismiss the complaint at this time. And Dr. Garcia is here with me and available for any questions the committee members may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Davis-Wilson, do you have any questions for Dr. Garcia?
I do, but I'm wondering if you have any, if you'd like to go first, because we might have similar ones and you probably have the framing from the psychologist perspective, and then I'll supplement from there if you don't mind.
Okay. I'm looking at the records. Ms. Stark, you said you did not receive any information about the testimony, and we have a minute entry from 9/29/21. Did you receive that?
I did, but we don't have an actual transcript of the hearing.
And Dr. Meyer, just to clarify, I did request from the complainant MG that she provide that, but I have not received anything at this time, so I do not know what the status of that is.
Okay. So I guess just to make sure the information is correct here, Dr. Garcia, did you ever meet with your client's son?
No.
Okay, so all of your information was based on just the report from your client?
Correct.
Okay, and in the letter that you submitted in 2020, I just lost the date of that.
Yeah, January 30th, 2020.
Thank you. You did provide an opinion that it is your professional opinion that your client is able to have unsupervised visits with his son in order to maintain the positive and mutually rewarding relationship that they currently have. What was that professional opinion based on?
Solely my 10 years of work with the patient.
Okay, and is that a...
Well, and I fully understand that my opinion was without qualify. I didn't qualify or properly limit my statement. And I'm sorry for having not done that, because you're right. That is, that's something that I should not have done.
So do you see that as practicing outside of your scope or outside of your professional expertise?
Yes. Because at that point I should have qualified and I should have properly, limited my opinion on just my meeting with him, my knowledge of him as a patient, his therapeutic progress. And
okay. Have you done any custody evaluations or do you work with children just in therapy?
Yes, children, starting with age 10, even younger for gifted and precocious children, starting at age 8.
Okay. But any type of custody evaluations or parenting evaluations, anything like that?
No.
Okay. Those were the only questions that I had. Thank you, Dr. Garcia.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. In follow-up to that, I guess I'd like to hear from you, Dr. Garcia, in kind of your thought process as to, we can request the transcripts for the actual testimony, but we have three letters across, a 6-year span in which on three separate occasions, opinions about parenting was provided. Can you just kind of provide to me, provide to the committee what kind of your rationale was, what the ask of the letters was, what your understanding was as to why the individual asked for the letters, and kind of what your rationale was for then providing comments or statements on parenting.
And Dr. Davis Wilson, sorry, if I can just jump in quickly and ask that we limit the conversation to the 2020 letter, as the 2014 and 2016, I believe, are outside of the scope of what the board can investigate at this point in time. I think Ms. Galvin.
Ms. Ms. Galvin, are you available?
I am here. Sorry, I was having trouble with my sound. Could you repeat that question?
I had just asked that the allegations be limited and the discussion be limited to the 2020 letter, as the 2014 and 2016 letters are outside of the scope of what the board can investigate pursuant to 32, 34, and the 4-year timeframe.
And I would agree with that request. The board has jurisdiction over what occurred in the last 4 years.
Thank you. Then I would just rephrase that then to being specific to the 2020 letter. What was the ask of your client, of your patient, and what was your understanding of what the letter was going to be used for?
I was requested to talk about his therapeutic work with me and his progress.
But you were unaware that the letter was going to be used in the custody?
No, I did. And that's the mistake I made in that one sentence where I opined without, properly, qualifying and providing limits to that statement. That's the part that I'm saying. I understand that I made that opinion incorrectly.
Okay. I think that's the only question that I had clarification on.
Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. Thank you, Dr. Garcia. The committee will now begin deliberation. Please note this is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys. Dr. Davis-Wilson, do you want to begin deliberation?
Yes, I apologize. I was trying to pull up the document. I had it open and it is now closed for the violations. But generally in just discussion, I'm concerned about the scope of practice and the violation of boundaries of competence. I think that this went and possibly even multiple relationships, because I think this went beyond the therapeutic relationship of the individual. I think the outcomes could have been extremely dangerous to the minor child had it changed the mind of the courts. And I would suggest that the letter in and of itself, the 2020 letter in and of itself, would be enough to go ahead and forward this for an investigative hearing for the full board, but that I would also be interested in as part of that hearing, seeing a copy of the transcript to see what changed in kind of the perspective and the role when it came to the actual verbal testimony.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that this and I just lost it now. This is a potential violation of 16G, engaging or offering to engage as a psychologist in activities not congruent with the psychologist's professional education, training, and experience. In regards to the multiple relationships, typically that's in holding different relationships with the client, and that could potentially be harmful. And I see this more as just the overstepping of what she should have reported or opined on, as opposed to any kind of problematic relationships with the client. I do see that there were potential ramifications for others, but I think I'd have a hard time arguing that this is a issue of harmful multiple relationships with the client.
And I can understand that. Just to give a little bit of the rationale and why I even brought it up, I think the concern for me is partially one, the and perhaps there's a different code that better fits, but is one, the comfort and ease in misunderstanding the role of the psychologist from the perspective of the patient, in the fact that he was even able to make that request, and there not be any process or no redirection, no acknowledgement of, hey, this is outside of my scope. So much so in a way that then an attorney was able to say, hey, can you come and testify to this? And hey, it's COVID and we don't have addresses and what have you. I could send a subpoena or you could just agree to do this. And so I don't know what's best fitting. I think scope of practice is part of it, but even just procedurally getting to the point of being able to objectively make a decision that, is in the best interest then of the patient, which could have been like, nope, sorry, you're going to have to send me that subpoena, or, hey, here's other avenues of what we're going to have to do, or setting that, like, I can testify to this, but I am unqualified or unable to do this. There just seems to be, for me, a potential perspective on behalf of the patient and speaking to also, you know, patient representation by, their attorney as to what role the psychologist even had.
See, and I see that as a competency issue.
Okay.
But happy to include that in a motion for the full board to discuss. I think it makes more sense to include that and have it be a full discussion as opposed to limit discussion on what we can have. I think that when we are looking at 16DD and ethics, we do see the 2.01 boundaries of competence that includes this. If we look at multiple relationships, when a psychologist is in a professional role with a person and at the same time in another role with the same person, or promises to enter into another relationship in the future. And refrains from entering into a multiple relationship if the relationship could reasonably be expected to impair the psychologist's objectivity, competence, or effectiveness in performing his or her function as a psychologist, or otherwise risks exploitation or harm to the person. So, yeah, I mean, I guess in this case, it's two different professional relationships, right? Where you're testifying as a therapist, but also making what should be objective determinations of the custody and parenting competency. So that would be 3.05. as well. So I would make a motion to move this case 22-08 to the full board for consideration of violations of what is it?
I think you said 16G.
Yeah. So ARS 32-2061-16G and 16DD, including 2.01 and 3.05.
What about 2.04, the basis for scientific and professional judgments? That psychologists worked in, psychologists' work is based upon established scientific and professional knowledge of the discipline. I mean, it's hard for, on the behavior analyst side, we have codes related to even being able to, and that's what I'm trying to kind of crosswalk over, even being able to make that statement without having adequately assessed or had the resources for or provided. Like to your point, there is no history of custodial work. There is no history conducting assessments in this area. And as such, the doctor did not coordinate with other professionals that would have been significant parties to coordinate with before rendering a professional judgment of this sort, did not observe the interactions between the individual and the patient or the child. So I'm not quite sure where all of them fit, but those are additional concerns that I have. And if it's still just part of 2.01, that's fine. But I'm still feel like I'm missing something as it pertains to even just making that statement without.
Yeah, I think that the 2.01 kind of trumps 2.04, that without the competence in this area, it could be scientific or unscientific. It's just the competence isn't there. And so if there was competency established, but they were not, but it was not based on kind of current scientific understanding, then I'd see 2.04. But we just don't even have that foundational competency established, which 2.01 does include addressing scientific knowledge about it. So it doesn't seem like adding 2.04 adds anything to this.
Did the committee want to consider section 9.01A basis for assessment?
That's what I would, thank you, yes.
Yes, that's more of what I am saying, thank you. Psychologists base the opinions contained in their recommendations, reports, and diagnostic evaluation or statements, including forensic testimony, on information and techniques sufficient to substantiate their findings.
That fits, yes.
Yep. Yes, so thank you.
9.01 as well. And then would request that staff attempt to obtain the hearing minutes for Dr. Garcia's testimony.
I have one other question, and again, I'm going to default to you, Dr. Meyer. On how you view this as a fellow psychologist, but 16O, providing services that are unnecessary, unsafe, or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice.
Yeah, I think that's a potential one as well. I think that does get at kind of the offering an opinion on competency that had the potential to be unsafe for the minor.
I would second that motion and support those findings.
All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you all for being here, and staff will let you know of next steps. Moving on to our final case, 3E, complaint number T-22-02. And let's see, sorry, just a second. Complaint against Michael Hoffrath. Dr. Davis Wilson, you're the lead. Would you provide a brief summary?
Yes, complainant AC became aware of, or alleges to have become aware of, unlicensed practice by Dr. Hoffrath, representing that they believe Dr. Hoffrath is misrepresenting himself as a psychologist, psychotherapist, and therapist, and that he claims to hold a PhD. The complainant believes the individual is practicing in both California and Arizona, so is filing a complaint with both states. AC does not know the doctor personally, but contacted him as a fellow alumni of the Pacifica Graduate Institute regarding some doctoral research that the doctor is doing with veterans. September 6, 2021, AC and Dr. Hoffrath held a phone call where they discussed their work and practices. AC felt uneasy on some of the reports and looked up the Facebook page, LinkedIn, and website for the individual's business, where he saw that he was presenting himself as a psychologist and therapist, but had no license or no counseling related degrees listed. The complainant did email the doctor to inquire where he received his counseling degree from, and felt that the response was aggressive in nature, and was and that felt that the complainant was the complainant alleges that the doctor felt the complainant was trying to challenge his qualifications. Dr. Hoffrath further stated that his skills as a therapist are validated by his own barometer, and that he would dare any agency or board to question this authority. AC did not respond to the email, but did include a copy of the email for our review. And staff did reach out to the doctor with the concerns. The response received on October 25th was a two-page response indicating work and qualifications that indeed Dr. Hoffrath holds a PhD. He worked as a health and fitness professional in California. He did move to Arizona after losing his home and his belongings to a fire. During this time, he did work under the supervision of a licensed psychologist as a trauma specialist. He is certified in Reconnect Integrative Trauma Treatment Model and provided us copies of that certification. He does state that the Sierra Tucson, where he was working, was aware that he was not a licensed psychologist, and therefore he never provided any psychological services to anyone in Arizona. He does acknowledge that when he moved to Arizona, he did make changes to his address on the website, but then had issues communicating with the website developer, and as a result has been unable to make additional changes to the website. He has been applying for research positions and academic faculty positions, so he listed Arizona address on his social media pages, so it was clear for potential employers. Dr. Hoffrath has stated that he completely took down his website and has no intention of reactivating it. He had no intention of holding himself out to the public as a practicing or licensed psychologist in Arizona, and understands that he should have been more cognizant of how the website and social media pages represented. him, and he takes full responsibility for his oversight and has taken remedial steps necessary to ensure that he is not violating any of the rules or statutes. He does intend to move back to California or Hawaii sometime in January of 2022. And that board staff did review the information and did find that, yes, the doctor did identify himself as a psychologist and that he specialized in combat-related post-traumatic stress, depression, anxiety disorders, and that he provides psycho-spiritual counseling and addiction recovery and family counseling. The board did review the page more recently on January 4th, and said that the website does say website undergoing maintenance. Please check back soon or email Michael directly. The board did also look at the Google findings of the doctor, where it does list the organization and as a mental health service, and also reviewed the Facebook profile, noting that, again, the doctor's listed as a semantic and EMDR depth psychologist, also listing an Arizona address, and services provided included therapy and family counseling. Let's see. The updated language on the LinkedIn profile as of January 4th does change the language to being a neuroaffective touch practitioner, and lists the services as spiritually based shamanic practices and works through the wisdom of the body, identifies processes such as semantic process, meditation, mindfulness practice, mythopoetic storytelling, initiation rites of passage, ceremony, and ritual. And that does conclude my summary.
And Dr. Meyer, the complainant indicated she would not be attending today, so we can hear directly from Ms. Stark and Dr. Hofroth.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Thank you both for being here, Dr. Hofroth and Ms. Stark. Would you please introduce yourself and if you have a brief statement to make?
Hi. Yes, thank you, Dr. Meyer. I'm Sarah Stark, and I'm counsel for Dr. Hofroth.
Yes, and I'm Michael Hofroth.
And I do just have a brief statement that highlights some of the items that we've already touched on in our written response, but I'll go through this quickly. Dr. Hofroth temporarily relocated to Arizona in the spring of 2021 because he lost his home and all of his personal property in the Woolsey Fire in California in 2018. He was unable to continue to afford living in California, and his intention was always to temporarily reside in Tucson until his claim was settled and then move back to California. During the time he lived in Tucson, Dr. Hofroth worked under the supervision of a licensed psychologist who was fully aware of his academic and educational training, as well as his credentials. The supervisor was also aware that Dr. Hofroth was not a licensed psychologist. He never practiced as a licensed psychologist or sought to hold himself out as a practicing psychologist in Arizona or anywhere for that matter during this time. Prior to relocating and taking the above referenced position in Tucson, he did maintain a website for his services as a health and fitness professional and a somatic healer. The website was created back in 2019 for use in California only. He never intended to use this website to market to Arizona residents. And again, his Arizona residence was always intended to be temporary due to his displacement. At the time, Dr. Hofroth's website and social media were maintained by a web developer who was supposed to update his social media pages to indicate that he had an Arizona address now, as he was applying for positions in numerous different states at that time. The addition of the Arizona address on his website was done at the initiative of the developer, and he never marketed or intended to solicit Arizona residents with this business website. Although Dr. Hofrath and his business never provided or offered psychological services or operated in Arizona, Dr. Hofrath acknowledges the concerns addressed in the complaint and has subsequently removed his website and updated his social media pages. After several long years of waiting, it's anticipated that his claim for loss related to the fire will be finalized in the spring, at which time he will then return to California to live permanently. He is currently pursuing a license as a registered psychological assistant with the California board and plans to complete any additional courses required by California to eventually obtain his full psychologist license in California. Dr. Hofrath is here on the meeting, able to answer any questions the committee members may have at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stark. Dr. Davis-Wilson, do you have any questions for Dr. Hofrath?
I do not. I do not know.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Hofrath, thank you for being here. Have you provided any mental health related, behavioral health related services in Arizona outside of a licensed agency?
No, Dr. Meyer, I have not, period.
Oh. Okay, and you're not doing any coaching or any other services independently?
I'm doing some somatic coaching, but I'm not doing, that's really about it. And that's, yeah.
And, is that here in Arizona, you're providing those services?
No, California.
So through telehealth services?
Yeah. Yeah. Under supervision. And I'm just offering somatic practices. That's it.
And what do you mean by somatic practices?
Basically helping people get grounded in their body, different variations of breath work, mindfulness, teaching them more about mindfulness, meditation. That's really what somatics is, or what I'm teaching now.
Okay. And
really, helping people get in touch with their body and their breath. So.
Okay. And you said you're under supervision for that?
Yes, sir, I am.
Who's your supervisor?
Dr. Adriana Trent Westbury. Westby.
And and their location is where?
In California, PCH treatment.
Okay. And then are you currently working at an Arizona agency at this time?
No, I am not. That's all the work I'm doing.
Okay. And based on your education certification, are you able to provide mental health services on an independent basis?
No, sir, I'm not. And actually, I just wanted to clarify something. On the Google listing, that has been changed to alternative healing.
Okay.
If I'm correct. I went through everything online and tried to correct everything that I could see and do to clarify everything.
Okay, thank you. Those are all of my questions. Committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case amongst themselves without interruptions. Dr. Davis-Wilson, would you like to start?
Yeah, I want to thank you know, the doctor for going through and very quickly making the changes necessary to the website and profiles. I go back to kind of our conversations around like life coaching, where the semantics are close, but just far enough. And one of the things that, you know, comes to mind for me is just in public perception, as far as the general public may not understand that simply having a degree in psychology doesn't qualify you to, you know, provide psychological work or what have you from a licensing perspective. And so I think being very cognizant, even though all of the other website changes have occurred and it appears as though individuals are unable to seek out psychological services for the doctor, just being aware that the semantics do matter, because the general public just doesn't understand the difference between that. As far as whether or not the holistic ritual approaches fall under something that is considered psychological services, I would have to default to you, Dr. Meyer. I generally personally do not see them as necessarily being psychological services, unless being done also in comparison to, and again, I go back to that life coaching distinction of the types of services that are being provided. But I do appreciate that the appearance for a public perspective has been remediated quite quickly.
Yeah. I continue to have concerns about the crossover and what is and what is not the practice of psychology, but in this case, I appreciate Dr. Hofrath's responsiveness and changing all of those. I would just kind of provide a bit of caution about when practicing telehealth as well, when you're going across state lines. That brings in a whole nother level of rules and regulations that should be considered. But at this point, I don't see any violations of the title rules. So I would make a motion to dismiss the case.
And I would second that.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. And that concludes this case. Thank you both for being here today for this. And we are ready to move on to agenda number 4, adjournment. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye, the complaint screening committee is now adjourned. Thank you all for your help.